Welcome to the BBB National Programs Podcast Better Series, where we will explore top-of-mind topics with business and industry leaders to understand the leading trends and innovations that continue to push the envelope in today's marketplace.
Thank you for joining us today on the Better Series Podcast. I'm James Lee, and this is episode 2 of our 3-part series, Retail Therapy. French philosopher René Descartes wrote, "I think, therefore I am," creating the foundation on which all of modern Western thought is based. Not to be outdone, some 400 years later, U.S. consumers created the basis for the modern economy. To put it in terms Descartes would understand, "I shop, therefore I am." And that is the title of today's episode, where we look at how the retail sector became the largest component of the U.S. economy, and how each of us as consumers play a key role in the rough-and-tumble world of commerce. Joining us today as our tour guide through the retail landscape is Michael Londrigan, a member of the faculty at LIM College in New York, one of the leading merchandising schools in the country, where he literally wrote the book on fashion supply chain management. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, James. I enjoy talking about an industry that I spent close to 30 years working in, having started my career in retail with JCPenney when they had their corporate offices in New York City. And now I get to educate the future leaders in the business of fashion at LIM College.
Well, this is going to be a great conversation then, because I've got a lot of questions. So, yeah, let's start with the retail sector is the largest component of the U.S. economy. That's a lot of people. So can you put that into context for us in terms of just how important a strong retail sector is to the overall economy?
Well, the retail industry is the largest private sector employer in the United States. They employ over 5 million people and account for about 6% of our gross domestic product. That covers all forms of retail, with automotive actually leading the way in terms of dollars. But from a fashion perspective, the U.S. consumers spend over $250 billion annually. Now, that's a lot of shoes, shirts, and accessories. Many of those 5 million retail positions are entry-level and employ folks along a very diverse line from all aspects of society. But one thing to note here, with the push on increased minimum wages in many states and nationally, this will eventually lead to higher prices for all consumers. So the stronger the retail sector, the stronger the overall economy, and more employment and more of a contribution to our federal treasury.
Let's look back. You know, so Brooks Brothers, they claim to be the oldest national retail chain, going back to 1818, which I guess was probably pretty easy to do, to have a national chain when there are only 15 states. But over time, it became obviously much more important and much larger. How did that happen, and why did it happen?
Well, Brooks can claim that title, as you know, and it didn't take much to be the oldest and the largest back then, given the lack of competition. The reality is that retail has always played a prominent role in the U.S. and global economy. Dating back before the department and chain stores, you had the peddlers, you had trading posts that were the lifeblood and the beginning of our retail roots. But retail really took off in the 50s and 60s. With the move to suburbia, people needed places to shop, and we saw the birth of the mall. Contributing factors to that growth were more disposable income, more leisure time, growing families, and all this contributed to the need for retail space. So much so that today we have more retail square footage per person in the United States than any other country in the world. And to put that into perspective, we have approximately 24 square feet per person compared to, say, Australia at 11 square feet and the UK at 5 square feet. And I know 24 square feet is about the size of some apartments in Manhattan.
Yeah, and in Washington. That's fascinating. Especially given that what Napoleon once said, that England was a nation of shopkeepers, to have a smaller footprint than does the U.S. Consumer have. That's interesting. So, yeah, we talked to the National Retail Federation in our first episode, and they acknowledged that there are fundamental issues forcing retailers to close locations. You know, that's kind of led to this, the media buzz around, is this a retail apocalypse or a retail renaissance? But they also made the point that the overall picture is not as bleak as you might think. So sitting where you do, from your perspective, teaching those future leaders of retail, what's going on? And should we as consumers be, and business leaders, be concerned?
Well, the NRF, the National Retail Federation, those folks, they live and breathe retail every day. So they have their hand on the pulse, and they really know that the industry, and you hear the people using the retail term, you know, retail apocalypse, and I prefer to think of it as a retail reality, where the balance of the square footage is coming more into line with the number of people shopping, and particularly how they're shopping today. You know, with technology, we have seen major changes in the way people view retail. And of course, when you have store closures, there's always a concern. And as the stores close, for me and for folks in education, it's the retail human capital where my concern is. As many of these positions are considered entry level, so when a retailer closes, the individual who loses their job now has to find another way to replace that income. And that's not so easy, especially in rural areas where retailers might have been the largest employer in town. So that maybe the magnitude of the closures has changed with big numbers. You hear hundreds and hundreds of stores. But the fact that retailers are going out of business is not new. And truth be told, many new retailers are opening to replace those that have been shuttered. They're not the magnitude. You're not seeing the large chains coming into play with hundreds of stores, but you're seeing a lot of smaller entrepreneurs opening up retail space. And the Retail Federation, National Retail Federation, is a strong component of that. They're very supportive of the retail industry, and we see time and time again, store closed, stores open, stores closed, and stores open. And an interesting note, if you look at the pure players, the folks from the online world, companies that have only had an online presence are opening up physical stores to drive traffic to their websites. Amazon, Warby Parker are just two of the ones that I know of. And one other addition, one thing we can't overlook too is the various means that people are shopping. TV, HSN, and QVC are still going very strong. They have a very strong following and create a very good presence in the retail space today as well.
I want to talk about the role of consumers in driving change in these retail markets. And what you just touched on sparked a thought that for most of global history, you had to physically go to a store. But now we're at a point where outside of the occasional door-to-door salesperson or the peddlers in the 1800s, there was no convenience. So what is it that consumers are telling us that they want that is driving this change today?
That's a great question, James. The consumers, you know, historically, manufacturers made products, retailers put it on the shelf, and the consumers bought it. But the dynamic shifted in the 80s and 90s and certainly continues today with consumers basically dictating the market and demanding products that they want, not necessarily what manufacturers can produce. Today, the retailers look to the consumer for direction, and this comes from celebrity and sports figures, the influencers, and the bloggers, folks like that who are using technology to drive change in the retail world. Fashion used to be top-down, with designers setting the trends. You'd go to the fashion shows and they would say, oh, this is going to happen and that's going to happen. But today, it is no longer true. Fashion comes from all aspects of life. It comes from what we call bottom up, from the street. It also comes from top down still, but even things that we call sideways. The trends come from anywhere today. And consumers are reacting to those trends and the retailers have to be able to jump in there and provide those products to the consumers. Consumers today, they're younger, hipper, they're less patient, and certainly technologically savvy. But the key is they want the products when they want them delivered and how they want them, and of all, they want them now. So it's technology that is helping drive the retail business in a different direction than in the past. But the real issue for consumers, I think, today, that they're looking for experiences over products. As a consumer today, across all age categories, if I ask someone, I'll give you $100, would you buy a shirt or a blouse, or would you prefer to spend it on an experience? And the experience is going to win out the majority of the time. And lastly, I think consumers are looking to buy from companies that are also considered sustainable and who care about corporate social responsibility.
You mentioned influencers, which sparked another question. That's that is and is not sort of a new phenomenon. I guess how it works is new. We've always had endorsements, right? Celebrity endorsements, sports endorsements, whatever. But this this phenomenon of influencers, which tend to be online and tend to be in fashion, do you see that expanding beyond that scope into the rest of the retail environment and to other types of business environments? Are we going to see business to business influencers?
I think you will see all sorts of different influences as we move further down with technology. The influencer, as you say, isn't something that's new. It's different use of technology. In the past, it would be the fashion magazines or even the TV commercials where you would have a spokesperson. So you would call them a spokesperson as opposed to an influencer. And they would be the ones that would be representing the product and telling the consumers, you know, buy this product because I think it's good. And now you have these so-called influencers who have followings on social media platforms that are driving retailers to put products in the store based on what they're saying. I look at it as I'm a little jaded when it comes to the influencers and the bloggers in today's world, though, I must say. Originally, bloggers, particularly, they bought a product, they liked it, they shared their view, and then their friends, their relatives, or whoever would participate in that. But today they're being paid. They're being paid for their endorsements. The influencers are being paid. And it's really not a true, you know, response to a product. It's those folks, I want to use the term shilling for those companies and driving, you know, profits.
Build on that a little bit here, because you and I, you know, live in an area where there are influencers, right? We live in large urban areas. And convenience, you know, factors into many, if not most, of the decisions that we tend to make. You know, you're in New York City. I'm in Washington, D.C. I don't need to go to the grocery store or a restaurant because I can have food dropped at my door in less than an hour. I don't own a car because I have Uber. I have the Metro. I have a subscription for a scooter. I go to the mall to look at something I'm likely to buy, but then I come home and order it. So, you know, that doesn't work, though, in small towns and suburbs, which is where we're seeing the hardest impact of these of the retail realignment. Yeah, how does that transition underway impact consumers in those areas, and what can they do to participate in the retail economy going forward?
That's a great observation. You know, we tend to forget about middle America, as retail is generally focused on the metropolitan areas. Let's face it, that's where the consumers are and where retailers think the money is. So for those folks in areas that are underserved by traditional retailers, you do still have online shopping, and you have, yes, you know, the TV that I mentioned earlier, QVC and HSN, and let's not forget mail order. There are still an important factor in the buying habits of those underserved populations. It might take them a little bit longer to get their products. They're not getting them, you know, on next day delivery in some of those areas because it doesn't exist. But there are ways for them to participate. And there are retailers today, such as Macy's and Kohl's, to name two, who are experimenting with bringing smaller format stores into neighborhoods that have healthy populations. More of a traditional downtown, where you once have seen a Woolworths or an H.L. Green, and now I'm really dating myself, which will translate into more smaller stores from bigger players in more rural areas. I think only time will tell whether that format does expand into those really underserved areas. The one store group, though, that I think does serve those less populated areas of the country are the discounters, the folks like Family Dollar, Dollar Tree, Dollar General. Those are the ones that come to my mind. You know, I drive around parts of New York in the Catskill Mountains, and you see retailers in places that you would not normally see stores. And most of the time, the parking lots have plenty of cars in them, and they are serving those underserved locales.
Last question, and I think your answer there sparked a little bit of, seems to be there's a role for entrepreneurs in all of this to fill in those gaps. If I want to join the retail revolution, what do I need to avoid so I don't become, you know, the overnight success that doesn't last very long, or the store that grows to be too big? What do I need to do to be successful if I'm going to join the retail world?
I think first and foremost, you have to listen to the consumer. You have to provide excellent customer service. And there was a time in the past where a retailer could count on customer loyalty, but not so much today. You know, with technology, consumers can research products in a minute or less and find places to buy or buy right there at that instance. They don't have to go to their favorite store anymore. And although the figures that I have heard have always put between 75 and 80% of all fashion products will still be bought in stores through 2025, it's clearly a way to define your target market. The retailers, the entrepreneurs, they really have to understand who their consumer is in order to avoid failure. That's really the key. And we talk about that in school all the time to our students. Somebody could have a great idea, a great product, a great concept, but if they don't properly identify who their customer is, they're not going to be successful. And the rule of thumb is basically that 80% of your business is going to come from 20% of your consumers. So if you have properly identified that target market, you should stand a good chance for success. But the really one of the big things, too, in my mind, is creating a point of differentiation. Don't just try to compete with the Amazons of the world, as that's a tough battle to win. Be different. That is not always easy. It's going to take properly identifying that market, and being different can feel hard sometimes. It means taking risks. And retailers, sometimes they don't really like to take risks. I know when I was in industry, we used to go what we'd call competitive shopping. We go out to the malls, we go to the different retailers, and many times we'd be in a mall and we couldn't tell one store from another because all the merchandise looked the same. So really, it's trying to find a balance between the use of technology, a point of differentiation, identifying that market, and staying true to your mission. Consumers don't want to wait, though. And although I think fast fashion is fading a bit, the consumer still wants a product on a timely basis. And again, let's not forget about sustainability and corporate social responsibility as consumer themes. With around 90% of all apparel and accessories being imported, consumers are starting to ask where the product's coming from, and those companies that are sustainable and socially conscious are the ones I think that are going to win in the long term. So setting up a couple of these ideas, these concepts, whether you're a small entrepreneur or going to be a large format online retailer, brick and mortar, thinking about the consumer is really the key.
Michael Londrigan from LIM College, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, James.
And thank you for listening to the BBB National Program's Better Series podcast and our multi-part series, Retail Therapy. Join us for our next episode, Boldly Going, where we gaze into a crystal ball to see what the retail experience will look like in the future. To be sure you don't miss an episode of our special retail series, subscribe now to the Better Series at bbbprograms.org, then click on the podcast tab. And as always, you can listen to more Better Series episodes on your Apple Podcast app or your favorite streaming platform.
You just enjoyed the Better Series podcast. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To learn more about our other shows, visit betterbusiness.blueberry.com. That's betterbusiness.blueberry.com. Follow us on Twitter at @BBB_NTL Programs. Send your comments and ideas to podcasts@bbbnp.org. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guest, not those of the BBB National Programs or its affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Blueberry's Terms of Service.